I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Saturday morning group at the 101. My sobriety date is August 30th, 1984, and my name is Sharon. And this is very unnerving. In my life, I've competed in public speaking competitions. I've been in plays. I've been in a lot of scenarios where I've had to address an audience. But in all of those scenarios, I could stretch the truth. Can't do it here. Not if I want to stay sober, and not if I want to honor you for the truths y'all have told me a day at a time that have allowed me and helped me stay here. Okay, now you know I'm going to be a crier. What happens with me and what has happened as a direct result of the blessings of this program is that as the feelings got unlocked, so I time travel and I feel the feelings I felt then. And it's unnerving and it's a blessing at the same time. This particular weekend is really a milestone for two reasons. 30 years ago this month, my sponsor was very, very ill. And I was 2 years and a couple of months in the rooms, and I just started to begin that process of trust and growing in these rooms. And I was so angry at God that she was sick and didn't know what to do with it. And I still had a hard time sharing stuff. You know, so I lived in a little duplex by myself. I had a dog. And I was slowly reclaiming my life that I had thrown away before I, you know, got sober. And God gave me a plumbing problem. And what that meant was that I had the opportunity to call a plumber I knew in the program who was in my home group. And I was able to talk to him. And he helped me through that evening. And then the next night, right about this time 30 years ago, I went to the Old Faith Chapter Club, and I'm one of these people that has had a foot in each 12-step fellowship pretty much since my early time, and one of the things that helped me recover and helped me get social was playing softball. My NA home group had, we were busy fielding a softball team. And after we beat all the other NA groups, we started fielding teams against the AA club rooms, where we demolished y'all as well. But at any rate, I'm at the Fifth Chapter Club, and the next morning a group of us are going to be at the fields in Oakland Park playing football, softball rather. And my friend Alan said to me, "Hey, you know, after the game tomorrow, a group of us are going to go on my friend's boat. You want to come?" I said, "Sure." The friend was Pat, my husband. Now, when I met him, I thought he was a pretty nice guy. I thought he needed work. I don't think I've ever told you that. I usually share that just at women's meetings. But you know, we didn't start dating until many months later because both of us were so socially stunted that if either of us flirted and blinked, we missed it. So this particular weekend, at different times, as things were being said and people were sharing their honesty with us, I would be time traveling back to different things. So I'm really all over the place. I want to thank the committee for this honor. It's mind blowing. I want to thank everybody for the kind words. Where to start? What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I don't have any real clear memories of ever being really happy when I was growing up. Like Tom shared today, I always felt on the outside looking in that something was wrong, and many of us have had those same things. You add that internal discomfort to, and then you throw in some mean girls and bullying and stuff like that, and you know, you try to develop coping skills. And one of my first coping skills was reading. I just read addictively. And I loved books because things were fair in books. It had a beginning, it had a middle, it had an end. Good got good, bad got bad. You know, there was some justice that I was not experiencing in my life. And that worked and worked. And achievement, I think, was my next way to try to cope. You know, I tried to be the good little girl, and I was expected of me. My parents had my life mapped out for me pretty much since I was born. The expectation, and I grew up in Charleston, South Carolina. I'm the oldest of four. The oldest three of us are adopted. As I understood my life from ever since I could remember, I was supposed to do well in school so that I could get into a good college, meet a nice, rich Jewish boy, get married, have babies, and do club work. And that was the plan. And, you know, so I was growing up just as the beginning of the 60s and 70s and all the rebellion, and that didn't feel right. And I hated Charleston. Oh, my God, I hated that town. Everybody knew your business, so you couldn't get away with anything. And I didn't know now much about, I didn't know then about resentments, but it was like whack-a-mole. You know, things would come at you. You didn't even know that you pissed somebody off, and it come at you years later. And one of my favorite stories is some years back when my mother was celebrating her 75th birthday, we happened to be in Charleston, and one of my friend's grandmother died. My mother was friends with the daughter. So my mother says to her friend, "Are you going to go to Miss Goodstein's wedding? Funeral?" And the other lady says, "Well, you know, I wasn't invited to the granddaughter's wedding, so I don't think so." And it's like, I couldn't wait to leave there. And in fact, I plotted my escape very carefully, because with achievement being the drug that I used for a time before I found alcohol and other drugs, I was on my way to going to school out of state and things like that. So, but there was still the mean girl stuff. And I just don't remember being happy. I remember accomplishing things, but it wasn't enough. You know, it was a restlessness, and there was something somewhere that was going to make me feel good. I wasn't quite sure what it was, but I was going to find it eventually, I hoped. I remember the first time I experienced alcohol to a little bit of excess. When I say a little bit, it was a seder. And, you know, when we're little girls, you're served grape juice, or at least you were in my family, but we had to help clear the table. So you clear the table and you drink everybody else's wine, because we didn't have any alcoholics, at least not at the Seder. And I remember that it was a nice, warm feeling, and I felt good. And I didn't associate it anything later. And then, you know, teenage stuff, I was always tall, and so I would be the one that would buy the wine, and we'd do stuff. And then we discovered other things, and you know, I just couldn't wait to leave Charleston, because the thing about Charleston is that once you get a bad reputation, you're messed up for life. Very few people can stay once you do something to ruin your reputation. You know, if you got a divorce, somebody left. It was just that way. So I escaped to the University of Florida. I was very happy to go there. I learned a lot of my best bad habits there. I wasn't in Gainesville 2 hours when I'm sitting around drinking beer and enjoying other consumables. And I was just, it was, you know, it was like a preacher's kid. You know, I was just, I won't say wild, but I had more than my share of partying. I was the mystery pledge at my sorority, because I only did it so that my parents wouldn't bother me. You know, my mother had very, very definite ideas about what college was like based on her experience 40-something years prior. Of course, she didn't know. She did not know. I was like, my third week, I'm on the phone. She says, I know, I had been invited to go to Jacksonville with one of my sorority sisters for the high holidays. So my mother says, "Do you need a note?" I said, "For what?" She says, "To leave the dorm." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" I says, "No, we don't need a note." She says, "Well, don't you have a curfew?" I said, "No." She goes, "You mean you can just come and go as you please?" And I say, "Yes." But, you know, so long as I got good grades, everything was cool, you know. And I managed to get through Gainesville, you know, with good grades. But, you know, I was really busy. I still wasn't a part of. I wasn't connected. Like I said, I was the mystery pledge. And what I learned to do, and I look back and now I see, I used to make tapes of music to kind of like create a mood. And, you know, I'd have Moody Blues study tapes and Allman Brothers rock out tapes and whatever. Just I worked really hard to create happiness, and it wasn't happening. And I kept thinking that the next something, it was going to be around the bend somewhere. And in the meantime, you know, I partied a lot. I mean, I earned my seat here. When I was graduating, my sorority sisters did a sketch, like, modeled on Saturday Night Live news, and the talk was all the bars that were going to close because I was leaving town. And I still have that, so it's not a figment of my imagination. I came across those papers. My way of coping with this outside unconnectedness had been like knowing stuff. When I was a teenager, I came to believe that if I knew enough stuff, you couldn't throw me out of a conversation at least, and then you might let me stick around for more. So I worked really hard to hoard information, you know, and I still do. You know, I have to read the newspapers every day. Just find that one little piece of minutia that I can contribute to a conversation, you know, and it's like, it is what it is. It has informed my entire life. Now my problem is that my memory's failing. So it used to be I could tell you I read something, when I read it, who wrote it, why it was important, and now it's like, oh, you know, I think I remember something about that. And this is a real problem for me because it's always made me seem to be a lot smarter than I am. And the fear of being found out, that's a big one for me, still is. I like I said, I drank. I managed to balance a little bit. I didn't want to go back to Charleston, and my father was my family was very loving, but they're very controlling. I mean, there's just no other way to say it. And I did not want to go back there. My father had told me once that even if I was married, if he saw me out late, he was going to send me home. And I believed him, and because you didn't argue with my father. And so I knew I didn't want to go back there. And I wasn't really sure where I wanted to be. And then, you know, like I said, they had this plan for me. So I found somebody that seemed to meet the bill and, you know, got married. And in the meantime, I was trying to figure out with what I was going to do with my life. And I said, you know, what are my skills? Well, I can read, write, and talk. You know, wasn't good with math, wasn't good with science, wasn't particularly athletic. You know, I was left-handed but couldn't figure out how to play which sport with what hand. And, you know, so really all I could do to figure out to make a living with that. I had an interest in journalism, which is what took me to University of Florida, but then I just didn't have the stomach or the discipline to finish that. And I had an interest in advertising, but I, hand to God, I believed I would run out of ideas. So I didn't follow that. So I decided I was going to go to law school. And, again, more knowledge to collect. And, somebody said it real, real well once, they're educated beyond their intelligence, and I believe that's what happened to me. And my former husband also was a year ahead of me in law school, and law school is really a bad thing for personalities. They really, like the same way they used to have on cigarette packs, or they still have on cigarette packs, the warnings, you know, should be warning, you know, dangerous to interpersonal relationships. You know, of course, we were probably the emotional equivalent of two dead batteries anyway, we just didn't know it. And, you know, I got married before law school. I was divorced before my third year. And then I was single. I was in Fort Lauderdale. And I was ready to party. The day that he moved out, I bought a bottle of Smirnoff Silver, a bottle of Johnny Walker Black, and a bag of pot. And I was good to go. And I was celebrating my independence again, just as I had done in the plane on the way to college, toasting my freedom. And on Fridays, you know, I would call up my friends so that we'd get together and go to happy hour. And, you know, I was a little bit of a social butterfly. I was still looking for something. I wanted to be sophisticated. I wanted to be a part of. And there was still something missing, you know. Alcohol was filling it, but, you know, and it was fun for a while. But then it got to be a problem. You know, blackouts, inappropriateness. I mean, we would have these parties at the end of the term. I mean, drink to blackout, you know. People would, you know, people that were fighting would make up and they didn't remember making up, you know. It was just all of that insanity that goes with a lot of excess drinking and not a lot of emotional maturity or arrogance, either one. But, you know, I had always looking something, the next hill, the next whatever, the next whatever. And then, you know, it was kind of, I was kind of running out of things to accomplish, I guess. And so I was just living my life. I had a dog. I got in custody of the dog. That was really all I wanted out of the marriage. And, you know, it was me and Pepper. We lived in a little duplex. I had a tea cart, and it was set up almost like an altar with alcohol. I had, now keep in mind, from the South in those days, you get these useless things for wedding presents, like silver trays and crystal decanters. So I had it set up kind of by height, and, you know, nicely done, and Waterford crystal and everything. But the problem was, I had, you know, with a dog, you live in these old places with terrazzo floors because it's easy to clean up. You just don't, you can't live anywhere with a dog. And I kept dropping the crystal. And, you know, so, and I would go out to drink, and I'd go out to bars and, you know, whatever. And one night, it was in 1979, it was a Friday night. I would set aside $20 or so to drink on, you know. And so I'd meet some friends, spend my money, I would spend your money, and then if there wasn't anything else to, I would leave. So I'm leaving, I'm drunk, driving north on Federal Highway, and somebody much drunker than me came out, totaled my car, sent me into the southbound lanes of Federal Highway. I'm going north, a place called Bojangles, doesn't exist anymore, Sound Advice is there now. So I'm taken to the hospital, and I remember I was in my favorite dress, got blood all over it. And so somebody's working over me and on me, and I hear him mutter something about cheap liquor. I took offense. I said, "Excuse me, Chivas Regal is not cheap." And I didn't get ticketed because the other guy was so obviously caused so much trouble, and I really thought I had handled it. So this is 1979, okay? And then a couple years later, Memorial Day weekend, it was like an all-day party. Friends of mine were graduating from school, you know, a couple years behind me. And so I'm sitting in I was living someplace else, and I'm drinking, you know, cheap wine in Waterford Crystal because it tastes better. And, you know, with club soda. And then, you know, so I'm drinking before I go to the party. I go to one party. I go to another party. And then on the way home from the fourth party, I get popped for DUI. And that was devastating to me personally. And, of course, you can't tell anybody about it. But I was able, you know, when you go to DUI school, the counselor they assigned me to was Peggy Kilby, God rest her. Some of you may remember her. And because it was Memorial Day weekend, I was able to explain it away as an aberration. And, you know, I conveniently had forgotten all of the other parties I'd been to. And, you know, I was really the reason I got picked up the last time was I did a drive-by at some old boyfriend. You know, and that was really, I was just not doing too, thinking too well. And, you know, so this was 81. And, had a probation officer, and then, you know, to do all those things. And then, so what that did is that turned me into a home drinker. So I had my altar, you know, I'm ready to go. And so I would sit around and listen to Dan Fogelberg and bemoan my fate, and I was just so lonely and miserable, and all I had was my job and my dog, and this went on and on and on. And I was really out of touch with my feelings, and I'm just turning into this emotional black hole. But I had been recruited to work at this office. Some people took a shine to me and they thought I might do well. And I'm working at this office, and I remember the gentleman says to me, "Are you happy here? We really want you to be happy here." And the most honest thing I said, I stopped, and because I was walking very purposefully somewhere, I said, "You know, let me think about that. I'll let you know." Because I had no idea about happy, sad, anything. I knew fear. I knew dread. I knew nervousness. I had headaches. I had stomach aches. Those were the extent of my feelings. I had a lot of psychosomatic issues my whole life from stuffing feelings. And I didn't know that I didn't know. And a couple months later, it had become obvious to everybody but me that I needed to go into treatment. So they had an intervention for me at this office. And the most honest thing I was capable of saying at the time is, "Well, yes, I'll do what you ask. All I have is my job and my dog." And so this was in August of 1984. And the odd thing was this, okay? Like I said, my sobriety date's August 30th, 1984. In the early part of August, I thought I had the world by the tail. Earlier that month, I had been, my belly button birthday's also in August, and there was this, I used to be involved in party politics, and I knew a lot of people and who did what, because that was my way of getting control of a place. I would read the paper, I would join an organization, I'd work my way up the chairs, I'd become president, I'd get a certificate or a trophy or something, and that would mean I had arrived and I was important, and then I'd sit back and give you my wisdom. But what happened was, I knew people everybody thinks they're important, you know, but at any rate, it was a surprise party for two gentlemen in the Carpenters Union, and when I go there, they had added me to the list, because I was also born in August, and there was some judges there, and there were people, and I thought, wow, how cool is this? This is like August 4th, first weekend in August. By 10 days later, there's an intervention, and the end of the month, I'm in treatment, and going, what the hell happened to me? No clue. And I really didn't even know what treatment was all about. I took Spanish language tapes because I was going to learn Spanish. I was irritated. I was working in Miami. I needed to know more Spanish. I had these tapes, and so I was going to learn. And I was really irritated that I had gotten season tickets to the Dolphins, because a lady that worked with me, every year they alternated custody from she and her divorced or her ex who got the tickets, and then she would sell them or he would sell them, and I had season tickets. I was like really irritated, and I knew nothing. So I was very fortunate. I had met a man. He himself had been very prominent back in the day. He'd been a very prominent lawyer and school board member and everything. And he had decompensated and left the area. And he's passed. His name was Andy Mavridis. He probably belonged in these rooms, but he never made it here. But he had come back to Broward County. He was working at this office I was at. It was a political office. And I looked at him. And, you know, he was looking down, and he was just shoulders rolled in, and I had this thought. It was like, oh, my God, that's going to be me, and I won't be 52. I was only 29 at the time. But I had a glimpse of my future. I wasn't even sure that happened, and it was kind of like a burp, you know. It's like you get a little bit of, and then you just shove that back down. And that was like, say, March or April. And then some months later, when everybody else saw that I was having difficulties, he made sure I got treatment instead of just getting canned. And I have a tremendous debt of gratitude to this man. And I see his son regularly. And I mean, I didn't understand what treatment was going to be about. So I get to the Beachcomber, which was a wonderful place. And there's a woman there who was, she was like, had one more week to go, and she gave me the first piece of advice I was getting ready to ignore, and she said, "If they ask you to stay the extra 2 weeks, do it." And I'm thinking to myself, oh, no, I got more important things to do, and da-da-da-da-da-da. She's still around today. I see her pretty frequently. You know, we laugh about that. So one of the things about the Beachcomber was that it was on the beach, and so I was like ready to go to the beach. And they had this policy during the afternoon time, you had to be there at least 5 days. I guess they wanted to make sure you didn't go into seizures. I know that now. I didn't at the time. And I thought I was more important because I didn't have to be detoxed. So I thought I was better then. But at any rate, so I'm really irritated. So somebody says, why don't you take your big book and go read the stories in the back? And I'm like, I'm muttering under my breath, I'm going to learn this shit cold. And because that's how I survived. If it was a book, I would learn it. And I'd spit it back to you. And I'd tell you what it really meant. And that's how I survived. It's the only way I knew how to survive. And it took a while for me to, well, it took a long time for me to figure out anything because I was like, it was like this little black hole and just, you know, a piece of coal in here because I had just gotten so just emotionally shut down. And I was watching people start to smile. And I was watching people get more comfortable with their bodies and their gestures, and I didn't know what was happening to them. I just knew it wasn't happening to me. And here it is, something else. It's just not happening to me or for me. And I did agree to stay the extra 2 weeks. While I was there, the dog that I love got loose, got hit by a car. I found out that the job I thought I needed to save wasn't going to be there either. And I stayed. I don't know why, but I did. Some people thought I was going to bolt, but, you know, I'm one of these people, sometimes I don't know better. And other times I'm too smart to know better. But that was one of those times I was just too dumb. It occurred to me that if you're going to spend some money to go to a treatment center, don't use while you're there and don't leave. Made sense to me. That was about the only thing that made sense. I didn't really believe that I was an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. After 5 days, I was able to call my parents, let them know I had gotten there safe, and my father said to me, you're not alcoholic, you're just overworked and depressed. And a part of me wanted to believe him, but the part of me that was starting to open up, you know, the little gyroscope that we get, I knew that he wasn't right. I knew that there needed to be something that I had to pay attention to. But I was so conflicted the whole time. And I'm getting ready, you know, time is running out, it's the end of the 6 weeks. I was supposed to leave on Thursday, October 11th, and I know the date because it was my father's 60th birthday. And it's a Saturday night before that. And I went to Joho, and for those of you who know and remember Joho, she didn't mince words. I've come to call her my brain surgeon because she did the most digging in my head in treatment. And so I went to Joho, and I says, you know, Joho, I'm just... My head hurts, my stomach hurts, I just don't know what to do. And she said to me, well, you've never trusted other people. Now you know you can't trust yourself. You're bad with abstractions, and you're arrogant. And I could have lived with the first three, but the fourth one really pissed me off. Because I tried really hard not to be arrogant, even though I was the best educated person there. You know, I just thought... You know, I was a book. I should get this. I had two of them. You know, so that night, the owner of the treatment center spoke. And he said the words that opened up things for me just enough to keep me here. And what he said was, it's real hard to believe in a higher power when you think you're it. I was like, whoa. You know, I had been trying so hard to think my way out of the jackpots I was in. I had even written in my 12 and 12, I'm just, all this change they want me to do, it would just be easier to die. And I really believe that. So that opened me up for just enough so that, you know, I was okay to leave. And that little bit of the it, not as much of the it as I saw with other people, I went and I made a list of meetings and did all the things they were supposed to do. I had an aftercare plan. So my first Sunday out of the Beachcomber, I went to the 101 Club because I'd heard they had breakfast. And it's 11 o'clock, so if it's 11 o'clock meeting and serving breakfast, well, you should get there around 9:30, right? So I get there, and in the corner by the podium is this guy, and he's sitting with some other guys, look kind of, ugh. And listen, I didn't drink at any places much worse than my own apartment. I mean, not that it was fancy, but, you know, I thought I was really high-quality stuff. So, at any rate, it turns out this guy was Kenny Kane. And he was so kind to me. But I looked at him and I thought to myself, you know, this is an older version of every man my father warned me about. And I was right. My father had been in ornamental iron, wrought iron, and steel as a small manufacturer in South Carolina. He broke a union, and Kenny was a union iron worker. So, but he was also a bar, you know Kenny, what am I saying? But at any rate, I for some reason, I was able to stand up and say that, you know, I was new, and people took care of me. I don't even know what possessed me to do that. I didn't have a job. I know now it was depression, but in those days, he really only had benzos, and I was afraid of meds and I hate doctors anyway, so. It didn't occur to me that for the hour I was safe in a meeting that I could have gone to more meetings. Go figure. And after a time, I started to meet people a little and trust just a little. I was go to big book meetings and you know, I was going to the right meetings and starting to meet people slowly. And everybody was so kind, and I didn't get it. Why would they be kind to me? I didn't have a job. You know, everything about me that I thought was important didn't exist anymore. Because, you know, I was kind of like real hollow. You know, I was a bunch of certificates, trophies, and other things, but there was no inside, no substance. And as I began to listen to you people and see that you were real, I started to feel a little safe. It's real hard to find a God of your understanding if you can't trust people. That was my experience. I was a student of religion, but I didn't really have a real sense of what worked. And when I had been at the Beachcomber, they had brought in some meetings, and there was this guy, some of you may remember him, his name was Jeff Sherman, and he was kind to me. And he was safe, you know, he didn't seem to be like, you know, a bar guy or anything like that. I trusted him. And he was one of those people that said things at just the right time when I needed to hear it. I was at Serenity Beach, and I thought Serenity Beach was just cool as could be because, wow, we have our own beach. We got a book, we got the beach, you know, things are working out. And we're at Serenity Beach one day, and I'd gone to meetings and everything. I had a temporary sponsor. Oh, me and sponsorship. That was a journey. What was a sponsor going to teach me if there wasn't a lady judge? That was my thinking. And there were no lady judges in recovery at the time. And I thought I would be intimidating to people who weren't, you know, as well educated as me. I was so freaking stupid, and I didn't know it. So, at any rate, I was assigned a temporary sponsor, and I would call her at all the wrong times on purpose, just so that I could say I called. But when I heard she had other women she was sponsoring, I got upset and I got jealous. So that didn't work so well, but I'm at the beach one day, I'm talking to Jeff, and he says, well, what step are you on? And I says, well, I think I'm on the third step, because I'd been reading regularly, because I knew how to read a book. And then we're talking a little bit and whatever, and he says, oh, and by the way, who's your sponsor? And I had what I call a momentary hiccup of honesty, because it came, you know, very infrequently. I didn't talk much. It was easy to be honest when you don't talk. So I just had this slight momentary incident of honesty, and I said, you know, I really don't have one. And he said to me, how in the world can you turn your life and your will over to the care of a power greater than yourself if you're not willing to turn it over to the care of a sponsor? And I was like, oh, and then he kept going. And he says, don't you know you're walking on a cliff lined with banana peels? And I got that visual. So right about that time, I had seen this woman, and she seemed to just exude spirituality. I mean, she just seemed to be on fire, like if you touched her, you might burn yourself. And she just glowed. And she was a therapist on top of it, so I says, I'll ask her. I'll get some spirituality and I'll get some therapy all at once. This will work out great. And after about 3 weeks, she figured out what I was up to, and she suggested I look elsewhere. And she said she would have caught on quicker, but she'd had some issues with her grown children that kind of distracted her. So I go to a meeting, an Asket Basket meeting, and I tell my version of the story. And they said, you know, get another sponsor. Oh, okay. So I had been attending a lot of different meetings, and I had seen this woman. And it's like asking somebody for a date, you know. It's so unnerving. It's like Sadie Hawkins Day dance. And the woman that I asked is still my sponsor today. And I've come to believe that if you don't think you have the best sponsor, go find him or her. If you don't think you have the best home group, go find it. It's there, waiting for you. The blessings that come from a relationship of between a sponsor and, she used to call us her babies, now she calls us her lovelies. And it's just mind-blowing. And a lot of these women I've grown up with. And it's a lot of things in life I could not have done without the support and guidance of a sponsor. As I mentioned earlier, I met Pat at about, you know, 2 years, 2 months, and I don't remember when it looked like it might go somewhere, but I had to make sure that somebody else I trusted saw what I thought I saw in him. And so I don't remember the circumstances of how I got her approval and how they met. That much I don't remember, but she gave me some very, very important advice, and that was stay out of his program. And it was the best advice that could happen. We didn't go to the same meetings. We didn't do a lot. I mean, and it's worked out well that way. I thought everybody finally knew after all these years that we were married, and then Joni was the only one that didn't. And I know Joni since 1986. But but that's it. And I just stay out of his way. And if I talked about him, I didn't identify him by name. So, you know, the names were changed to protect the guilty. So, but even before then, I had started little by slowly with the help and support of a sponsor and a sponsorship family, because that is as valuable, but it's really hard. I can't imagine my history in this program without my sponsee sisters. Very early on, I remember there was a group of us, and we were meeting at somebody's house, and Faye says, you are the future sponsors. And I looked and I go, no, it can't be. You're going to take care of us. We're not going to have to worry about this stuff. And all these years later, here we are. But I was beginning to reclaim my life a little bit at a time, you know, get back to finding a job, get back to making a relationship. You know, when we come here, it's just about staying away from the drink, and then we just reclaim little pieces of our life, and we get the opportunity to exercise good choices in our life. And so everything was falling into place except my social life, because I was deathly afraid of those three-week AA relationships that everybody talks about when they flame out. Because I grew up in the South, and that's all we did was talk about, you know, all the things that people were doing wrong. And so I just knew everybody would be talking about me. So I just stayed away. In fact, the truth was I was just afraid of people. I didn't even realize how afraid I was until many years later. I'll tell that. Larry Starr died, I don't know how many years ago, and we're at his wake, and I'm looking at pictures, and I'm sitting with Maurice, many of whom y'all knew. And Maurice says, well, where were you? You were here then. And I just kind of looked. I says, yeah, I don't know. But I did know. I was afraid. I'd come to meetings with you. I'd go to meetings. I'd go out after with you to meetings. But when it came to the weekends, I didn't go anywhere. I stayed home. I was deathly afraid. And I don't even know what I was afraid of. But, you know, the hurt and the pain, childhood, bullying, mean people, all that other stuff, it doesn't go away. It took a long time to get over. At any rate, so I'm reclaiming my life little by slowly, bit by bit, and but there was no relationships. And I'm like, oh, geez. So I remember one day I'm sitting in my little apartment and listening to music. It's a Sunday afternoon. It's a nice day. The breeze is going. And all of a sudden I realized, if it doesn't get any better than this, this isn't so bad. And so a couple of months after that, you know, again, I was starting, where's the boyfriend? Where's this? Where's that? Everybody else seemed to have something, and I didn't. So I'm in a meeting, I was watching this episode of L.A. Law. So it's around Valentine's Day in 1986. And the little fat lawyer says to the real tall, pretty one, I can't imagine any more thing that would give me more joy than to wake up with you every morning. And I'm listening to this, and I burst out crying. I says, I can't imagine anyone that even wants to say hello to me on a daily basis, much less wake up with me on a daily basis. And I was able to restrain myself and not call my sponsor until the next day and tell her my tale of woe and how my heart's breaking. And she says to me, oh, Sharon, she's from New York. She says, oh, Sharon, don't worry. Even now, God's molding someone in a treatment center for you. I said, but Faye, I want someone with time. And months later, it was, you know, this is in February, so October I met Pat, and then after years, while we start dating. So again, new dimensions in perilous in relationships. But, you know, life has been, life on life's terms is so much easier with the support of your friends, your sponsors, your sponsee family, and the program of recovery. I cannot imagine going through this because, you know, when you know, we got married, Pat had never been married before. You know, I'd been married and done, you know, but I didn't know how to have a really good relationship, and I had to work out a lot of entitlement issues because I was raised to be a Southern Jap, you know, and that's one of those, they probably have a DSM code for that now that they've expanded the book, but it's a really, really, really warped sense of entitlement that you have to work through, for me. I'm Marco Rubio here. At any rate, it has been, you know, we've been blessed, but it takes work, you know. Blessings, you know, there's a lot of luck in many ways, but a lot of times you make your luck, and we have the opportunity to do that when we're here. And we've been blessed with two sons, and so when we're getting ready to celebrate our third anniversary, and our first son was a honeymoon baby, so here we're coming up on our third wedding anniversary, and we're going to go to the Keys. And I was so excited because we had honeymooned in Key West. I really liked it, and I'm looking forward to it. And Pat comes home, and he goes, we're going to Lake Byrd. I said, what? What's Lake Byrd? He says, well, I'm not real sure, he says, but there's a lake, and there's rocking chairs, and you walk around the lake, and there's a lot of pie, and there's a lot of good food, and the men play golf, and the women go to Walmart. I was like, huh? Really? That's what I remember, okay? That's my version of it. I'm sticking to it. And, you know, God bless these women. They're wonderful women, but they seem so much older than me. And I'm older than they are now. But, I mean, I'm older than, it's like, why are we doing, I want to go to the Key West, you know? And we went, and we loved it. And we went as often as we could up until the last Lake Byrd. And then About that time, our two kids, because we had another one, actually the second one was a Lakebird baby, and I called them Nitro and Glycerin, you know, and they're good boys, but you put them together, and my in-laws couldn't handle them anymore. So there were a number of years we couldn't come here, and then we came back again, and our older boy decided to have a party, so we had to put it off again. But, you know, we're very, very blessed. As Pat said last night, I adore our sons. We have a good life. We have, and it's a direct result of trusting and watching. I've tried to spend a lot more time listening than I do talking. I don't usually like to do this, but then you give me a microphone, I'm ready to go. The blessings that come and they're just awesome. And it's hard to imagine. I could not have imagined that. I was ready to die. I'd been committing suicide on the installment plan for a very long time, you know, stuffing feelings. And I could not see 32 years ago what it was that was worth living for. But I figured that, you know, all of you people, you seem to really believe in it. So, you know, I'll listen, I'll do, I'll try. And it took a long time to trust. And the most, two most important things are that my, the most important thing, two things she told me. Number one, stay out of his program. That was key. But before that, before I even knew there was a Pat, we had sat down to work on our second step. And she had asked me to make a list of the attributes of a power greater than myself. And I sat down and I wrote a list and I said, I want a higher power who can't keep track of my sins, or better yet, can't even count. And I had a lot of other things behind that. And, you know, we talked about it, but the most important thing she told me was that this understanding of a power and a higher, of a power greater than myself, or a higher power, could grow and change as I did. It did not have to be perfect. It did not have to be static. It could grow with me. And by watching, you learn. I learned more by watching, and then after a while I would do it. There was a lot of fear with every step. I got stuck on the fourth step. I didn't want to do it because I don't like evidence. And I didn't know enough shorthand to write my fourth step in shorthand. You see, my father had told me in high school I should take typing in shorthand in case I got divorced. But I didn't use it well enough. So, you know, I got stuck. So I participated in BARC's experiential learning program. And I participated in their therapy groups. And I got a lot out of that. I needed the help. I was so bottled up, I would open my mouth and cry. People say, how are you doing? I'm fine. And tears are streaming down my face. Fine. Well, we know what that means. I don't know if I can say it from this particular podium. It almost seems sacrilegious. Anyway, fricked up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. I was that for a long time. The other thing that happened to me that it almost seems like an outside issue, but I need to share it because it may help somebody. I was able to develop a real comfortable working relationship with a higher power, but I also smoked cigarettes like a fiend. When I came into recovery, I was a pack-a-day smoker, and by the time I left treatment, I'm a two-pack-a-day smoker. And there came a point where I got a case of bronchitis I could not smoke through. I cannot claim that I made a decision and actually, you know, quit smoking. But that, you know, what happened was I had a moment of clarity. I bought the patch. I suffered through it. I drove everybody crazy around me. But what happened is that whatever understanding I had of a higher power is almost like it was gone. It was like I was disconnected all over again. And it was like losing a friend, and I guess cigarettes were my friend. You know, they kept me company from the time I opened my eyes. Even before I opened my eyes, I'd be reaching for a smoke. And it was just like that for me. And I would go to meetings and I would cry about that. Nobody gave me a hard time. I've come to believe that there are serenity issues and there are sobriety issues. And if you don't address the serenity issues, they're going to turn into sobriety issues. And smoking is one of them for me, and that's why I felt it's important to share it. I don't think there's any issue that shouldn't be shared if it affects your sobriety. Where you share it may be another thing, but you got to share it. You can't hide it. I've seen people relapse believing that they should be better, they should know better, or that with so much time they should be spiritual giants and they can't have a resentment. Please, my first resentment that I knew, recognized for a resentment, I didn't get elected to chair my home group. I was irritated because I wanted to chair. It was my anniversary month, and I called people to show up to that meeting and vote for me. And one of the people I called to show up and vote, they gave it to him because he needed it. I was so mad. And I'm driving home, and literally, physically, I was holding on to shit. I was constipated from this resentment. And the other thing that I love to share is about the alcoholic mind, which we all suffer with. I had had an illness before I came in here called endometriosis, and I had been told that if I ever had symptoms again, I would have to have a hysterectomy. This, again, was before I met Pat. So I'm driving home from a meeting, and I get a twinge. Say I'm at Andrews and Commercial. By the time I was at Dixie Highway, I'd made a list of everybody that didn't come to the hospital. And I was telling some nameless, faceless man, yes, I'll marry you, but I can't have children. So the alcoholic mind is a horrible thing. As my husband says, a mind is a terrible thing to have. But I come here so that I can reboot it regularly and frequently because I need to do that. The blessing in my life today is my sponsor, my sponsee sisters, and the women who allow me to sponsor them. They fill my life in a way I never thought possible. Next week, I'll be at a retreat farther north of here with my sponsorship family, a large part of them. My sponsor has a number of women that she sponsors. Many of us have a lot of time, so we're not, you know, real high maintenance. I'm looking forward to my grand sponsors, people, and it'll be probably anywhere from 60 to 100 women, who knows, and that won't even be the whole tree. You know, the way we have the opportunity to influence each other for the better is just awesome. In rooms like this, we learn the difference between awe and oh. And I spent a lot of time, you know, miserable, and I much prefer the awe. Thank you.